to LabCorp Perspectives Oncology, where we connect on cancer, science, and patient care. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Previs, and I'm a director of medical affairs here at LabCorp. With me today is my colleague, Dr. Heidi Koh, who's also a director of medical affairs here at LabCorp, as well as a breast medical oncologist. Heidi, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Becca. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Now let's jump right in. Today, I want to focus on an increasingly hot topic, and that's the rise of tumor-agnostic therapies. So first, let's start with some historical context. And the rise of tumor-agnostic therapies represent really a paradigm shift in oncology, where instead of treating tumors from where they're based or the tissue of origin, where they started, we're treating more based on the biology. And by that, I mean specifically the underlying genomics of each person's individual tumor. And really, this started with the first tumor-agnostic approval of pembrolizumab for patients with microsatellite unstable or MSI high, or sometimes we refer to as mismatch repair deficient tumors. And this was approval happened in 2017. So from your perspective as a medical oncologist, why was this so transformative in precision oncology for both genomics as well as in immunotherapy?
Yeah, you know, Becca, the 2017 approval of pembrolizumab for MSI high or deficient MMR tumors was really a major turning point in oncology, not just for immunotherapy, but just how we think about cancer treatment overall. And I think what made it so transformative is that it was really the first time that the US FDA had approved a therapy, a cancer therapy, based on a tumor biology or molecular context or features of a tumor rather than where the tumor has originated from, as you were saying before, or the tumor histology. And, you know, this kind of really brought it to our attention that the molecular features that are shared between tumors is really important for cancer therapy. And that shifted our way of thinking that tumor biology is just as important as tumor anatomy or histology.
And in such a short amount of time, we've made a ton of progress in this space. I think we're now up to 6 tumor agnostic approvals.
Yeah. It validated the idea that, you know, this shared genomic or molecular alterations across many tumor types could be actionable. And I think in a lot of ways, that approval of pembrolizumab for MSI high or deficient MMR tumors was really a blueprint, right? It laid the groundwork for other tumor-agnostic biomarkers that followed, you know, like the NTRK, RAD fusions, BRAF V600E, and more recently, HER2. And then it pushed, you know, genomic testing and CGP more to the forefront and made, you know, by CGP, I mean comprehensive genomic profiling, not just a research tool, but really a clinical necessity in cancers, particularly solid tumors.
Now, of course, tumor agnostic doesn't mean one size fits all. And, you know, we can't just apply therapies to any patient at any time during his or her own specific treatment journey. In your perspective, you know, what are some of the biggest scientific or clinical challenges that we still face with these therapies?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. One of the biggest hurdles is that not all tumors with that share, you know, same genomic or molecular features will behave the same way. So a very good example of this is BRAF V600E mutation in melanoma versus colorectal cancer. So we know that in melanoma, patients with BRAF V600E mutated tumors, we can give, you know, BRAF MEK inhibitors, and we know that the response rate to those therapies is quite high. But in colorectal cancer, we know that there's more resistance to, you know, BRAF MEK inhibitors if we don't add on the EGFR antibody like cetuximab. And so, you know, the response to BRAF MEK inhibitor is different pattern for that in melanoma versus colorectal cancer. And so I think, you know, while tumor agnostic therapies are really a huge leap forward in oncology, our work isn't over. I think there's still a need for more for fine testing, really deeper understanding of biology, how biology and molecular features interplay with tumor or tissue microenvironment, co-occurrence with other mutations is really important to understand.
You make a great point. I think we see so many of these approvals happen when patients have recurrent progressive disease after multiple lines of therapies. But do you think it's possible in our current treatment landscape to move these therapies up earlier in the treatment pathway? You know, or do you think they're going to remain in those later line use at the current time?
Yeah, you know, that's something that we are actively watching, I would say. But the short answer is yes. There is always a strong movement and push to bring these therapies more to the frontline setting. With that being said, however, you know, most of them are still used right now as standard of care in later line settings because that's where we have the most robust clinical trial data. But, you know, as trials show benefit in earlier settings, now that we've seen with HER2-targeted therapies, we will likely see more of these approvals moving into the upstream. That shift also depends on proving that, you know, they outperform the current standard of care and ensuring that biomarker testing is really incorporated earlier on in our clinical pathways.
Let's zoom out a little bit now and take the 10,000 foot view of the precision oncology landscape. In your view, you know, what does the rise of tumor agnostic therapy say about the future of precision oncology overall?
Yeah, you know, I think we're in a really, really exciting time, I would say. Tumor agnostic approvals really show that oncology is really shifting away from that, you know, disease-specific or histology-specific to more molecularly targeted or biology-based therapy, meaning that future precision medicine will really hinge on, you know, molecular profiling and really ensuring that we do a comprehensive molecular profiling for our patients. And I think this paves the way for truly personalized regimens and more adaptive, you know, biomarker-driven trial designs, you know, as we even think into more the earlier stage settings.
And I want to compliment you and give you a huge shout out for the recent review that you were recently the first author on in Frontiers in Oncology, where you discuss this recent tissue-agnostic HER2 overexpression approval and the rise of antibody drug conjugates. So congratulations. It was awesome.
Well, thanks so much. You're right. So in our recent review article, we did discuss how the tumor agnostic approval of trastuzumab deruxtecan or Enhertu has really transformed HER2 overexpressed solid tumor management beyond the traditional breast and gastric cancer, is really bringing durable, you know, clinical responses in tumor types like lung, colorectal, and other malignancies, and how this approval was really pivotal in that it was the first approval of an antibody drug conjugate that we can use across different tumor types, leveraging that protein overexpression, leveraging that newer, you know, antibody drug conjugate design really to enable precise delivery of that chemotherapy payload to those cancer cells having that protein overexpression. And, you know, we also discussed some of the limitations of in clinical kind of considerations around IHC scoring, how it may be prone to, you know, variability, subjectivity around the HER2 scoring, and emerging roles of next generation sequencing and AI technologies to really enhance, you know, the HER2 IHC scoring and just patient selection for these therapies.
Yeah, you guys covered so much in your review. And, you know, I think that was just so exciting.
Yeah, you know, I think I also wanted to ask you, Becca, I think as a gynon kind of like looking into that Destiny Pen Tumor 02 trial, how do you interpret that really impressive, you know, I think 80% upward, right, response rate that we saw in those patients with endometrial cancer having that HER2 IHC of like 3+ score?
I'm thrilled that you asked that. That 80% response rate for patients with endometrial cancer whose tumors have that high HER2 3+ expression and the response to trastuzumab deruxtecan is so impressive. And honestly, it has my attention among many other GYN oncologists. You know, we've been testing patients with advanced serous endometrial cancer for quite some time, since the publication of a phase 2 clinical trial by Dr. Nichols-Fader, where we saw an impressive response to patients who expressed high levels of HER2 to carboplatin, paclitaxel, and trastuzumab. But what is interesting about the pan-tumor O2 data is that HER2 expression by IHC, those 3+ tumors, is strong against many gynecologic cancer types, including cervical cancer, patients with ovarian cancer. For example, the response rate in cervical cancer was around 75%. And, you know, and even in ovarian cancer, historically, we've seen pretty low response rates to HER2-targeted agents. But for in that trial, we saw response rates of around 60%. And that's exciting and really such a huge improvement for patients.
That's amazing. It's really exciting time for, you know, GYN cancers, because, you know, I think when I was in fellowship, my GYN oncology attendings used to say, we need to do more research. We need to do more research for GYN cancers. It's super exciting. Do you think that, you know, most of the responders in that trial with endometrial cancer, do you think they have a particular histology, like serous histology, or do you think the response rate might vary based on the histologic subtype?
So we know histology plays a role. We know that molecular classification, especially in endometrial cancer, plays a role. But what the trial data are really telling me is that HER2 expression itself might be more of a powerful biomarker than we really previously appreciated. And that's regardless of the tumor of origin, the histology. And this really raises some exciting and important questions for me as a GYN oncologist. You know, should we be testing HER2 for patients routinely across gynecologic cancers? Should we retest them when they progress or recur? Do we rely on our archived biopsy samples from surgery, or should we get a new fresh biopsy? There's so many unanswered questions in this space.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to talk one more time a little bit more about, you know, your article. And, you know, we get this question a lot in the diagnostic space, so I think it's worth mentioning. We've been focusing on protein overexpression by IHC. How do you think about ERBB2 copy number gains or mutations when we detect them on next generation sequencing or comprehensive genomic profiling?
That's a great question. I would say that in essence, ERBB2 copy number gain, remember again, ERBB2 is that gene that encodes for that HER2 protein, right? So when we have a copy number gain in that ERBB2 gene that we detect on NGS, we would think that that reflects that gene amplification that should theoretically lead to that HER2 protein overexpression. But, you know, unfortunately, it's not a perfect one-to-one, just like everything else in oncology. You know, it's never a perfect one-size-fits-all, right? So NGS will tell you that they are extra copies of that ERBB2 gene, but it won't tell you how much protein the tumor is actually making or where that protein is localized. And then now, moving on to kind of the ERBB2 mutations, on the other hand, that's a different story. Now, mutations, these are changes that are happening in the gene sequence, often in the kinase domain, rather than increase in that copy number of the gene amplification. And certain activating ERBB2 mutations can indeed be clinically actionable. You know, we have seen that particularly in non-small cell lung cancer, where that is actionable. And then, you know, we have seen some ERBB2 mutations in breast cancer that can also be clinically actionable. So I think, you know, both ERBB2 mutations and ERBB2 copy number gain that we detect on NGS could be useful information, and certainly mutations are targetable. But, you know, again, it's not at least for the copy number gain on NGS, is not a perfect one-to-one to protein overexpression on IHC.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you the hard elephant in the room question. And that's whether a NGS result, like an amplification for ERBB2, can that be used as a surrogate for HER2 IHC overexpression?
Yeah, you know, that's definitely a tough question. But I would say that if you do see a high level ERBB2 amplification on NGS, say a copy number above a certain threshold, that strongly suggests that the tumor may be HER2 positive, by IHC. We know that in literature, we've seen that the ERBB2 copy number gain above a certain threshold is fairly concordant with IHC of 3+. And, you know, I think in patients where I have really, really limited tissue availability, and, you know, if I can just get one NGS for more comprehensive molecular profiling, I may lean on that ERBB2 copy number gain, especially if it's above a certain threshold, to kind of base my treatment decisions on. However, if we want to be, you know, 100% confident about treatment decisions, for sometimes we don't have that, you know, privilege to be 100% confident, I think we would still need to confirm with IHC, sometimes FISH in some certain cancers, to directly visualize that HER2 protein overexpression. So I would say bottom line is that NGS detected ERBB2 amplifications and mutations provide valuable, you know, complementary information to IHC. I would say that they're not standalone surrogates for IHC for protein overexpression at this time.
So it's complicated, like most things that we face in the diagnostic space. You know, you mentioned tissue stewardship, and I think that's critically important, especially as we prioritize tissue for all of these different testing methodologies for biomarker test. How do clinicians and oncologists prioritize HER2 testing among the increasing number of biomarker assays and biomarkers to test?
I think I say that sometimes, you know, we're in a really exciting era, but we're also in this, like, you know, challenging kind of clinical situation with this ever-changing treatment landscape in oncology, with, of course, new therapy approvals that are happening each and every day. We have to really think critically about what key biomarkers we need to, you know, information on before making that systemic therapy decision for that patient in front of us. So you would say every clinical scenario is, of course, going to be different, but using a broad NGS panel that reports, you know, the relevant ERBB2 copy number gains, ERBB2 mutations across genes and, you know, other tumor-agnostic biomarkers can really give you initial insights into HER2 and, of course, dozens of other, you know, clinically actionable molecular targets. And in some cases, as I have alluded to before, you know, where you have that really high ERBB2 copy number gain above a certain threshold, that, you know, where you might have tissue insufficiency, then you may want to just kind of think about in second line and beyond setting to see, you know, if patient maybe I may be able to select, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan for that patient if they have that high copy number gain on NGS report.
I think that makes complete sense. Now, what is your advice for clinicians, pathologists, oncologists out there who think a lot about workflows? How do they prioritize tissue for all of these tests?
I cannot stress this enough, but I say this all the time, that multidisciplinary conversations with our colleagues, whether it be surgical, pathology, radiology, really need to occur earlier on in the diagnostic journey, not just when we get to kind of the treatment decision, but, you know, early on in the diagnostic journey, to work with your pathologist to really allocate cores or sections, you know, upfront to really minimize tissue waste. And when tissue is truly exhausted, then a validated, you know, ctDNA molecular profiling test, we know that liquid biopsies are increasingly utilized right now, may be a good option to assess for these, you know, targetable alterations.
I love that. And, you know, I love these simple key takeaways. If you had to summarize the impact of Enhertu or trastuzumab deruxtecan in one sentence, what would it be?
Oh, man, that's a tough one, but I'll try to make it. I would say TDXT has really changed the game for HER2-positive cancers by really delivering a potent chemotherapy payload directly to those cancer cells that are having HER2 overexpression, really driving high response rates and durable remissions across many different cancer types. And I think that makes an oncologist very, very happy.
Yeah, well said, definitely from my perspective as well. So any last minute thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, you know, the one lesson I have learned from DESTINY-PanTumor02 study and other, you know, basket trials looking at a therapy across many different cancer types, it really opens up this exciting cross-cancer treatment options, but we have have to be mindful that, you know, that each tumor's unique biology and tissue context still matter. And we have to think about really all in one, not just like, you know, biology, but also like biology, histology, kind of how it interplays with the tissue microenvironment all matters. So we need to think about incorporating critical biomarker testing, doing a more comprehensive molecular profiling earlier on in the, you know, the patient care journeys, so that we kind of know what systemic therapy, what molecular targeted therapy that we need to pick for our patients.
Well said. I am so grateful for you, Dr. Heidi Koh. Thank you so much for today's conversation. I'd like to thank our listeners for joining us today as well. And we hope that you'll join us next time on LabCorp Perspectives Oncology.
Thank you.